All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and I'm so glad you're part of the show. This is our second hour of the week. Just want to remind you that this month of August, we're looking for 100 very special people. We want to increase our cadre of strategic partners, which I said in the last show, provide 50% of our income to Stand to Reason. And these are people that give on a regular basis. This is their commitment once a month, whatever it is. I think they give automatically. We just work it so it's really easy for them. And they keep us afloat. And they do that because they have gained so much from us. And they also want to make sure that we can give to others, not just to them. So in our training, our mentoring, in those in our community being built up as Christian ambassadors. And so this is why they say, okay, I'm on board, man. I'm signing up. Here's my pledge of allegiance to Stand to Reason, so to speak, my financial pledge. And so what we are doing this month is we are rewarding those who sign up this month. And our goal is 100. And I mentioned last week we're shooting for 30 between last show and this show. Last I checked before this show, 34 were signed up. So we're moving ahead. We're actually perfectly on pace. We're one third of the way through the month, and we're one third of the way into our goal of 100 new strategic partners. And so here's how it works. When you sign up in August as a new strategic partner with a monthly automatic gift of 25 or more, it's a place to start. And by the way, let me just pause for a moment. I didn't mention this before, but it just occurred to me, you know, there are a lot of young people that are part of what we do. And we had a lot of gray hairs, you know, people around for a long time. But we have more and more, since we are passing the baton, there are a lot more young people that are involved in learning and benefiting and paying it forward too, making a difference. And hopefully next week or possibly the last week of the month, I'll have somebody on. I heard an incredible story, just an incredible story when I was at CIA a couple days ago. And I want you to hear it too. But that's coming up. But anyway, and this is a younger person in 20s, it seemed, mid-20s. But young people are benefiting. And $25 a month is doable nowadays. You know, that's just like that's like one Starbucks a week. It's all that is. So I want you to think about coming on board, even at the lower levels, if you need to. We take any monthly gift, but we start at 25 here and for strategic partners. And you may want to join our ranks as a committed young person, committed to Christ, and out of your commitment to Christ, committing yourself to us because you're part of our community. And we're mentoring you. So anyway, go to what we're going to do is if you sign up, and I'll tell you where to do that in a minute. If you sign up, $25 or more, automatic gift, we're going to send you an SDR Tactics gift pack to the pastor or youth leader or Christian leader of your choice, because this is the way we magnify our impact. We can send it to you. You can use it if you want. But we want to do more than that. We want to have a leveraged impact to influence more people. And that tactics gift pack includes the original tactics book, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. It includes a tactics video study DVD, and it has 6 in-depth sessions. So this is something plug and play. You can have a whole group learn how to do tactics. And there's a quick reference card that comes with it. You can keep that for yourself if you want. And a free video download of tactics in engaging false ideas. So there's a special little item there that you get. You get all that by being a new strategic partner this month of August. And the way to do that, real easy. Go to str.org. That's our website, str.org. But add /partner. Now, I think if you just go to the website, you're going to – I think there's some information right there, front and center, about be one of the 100. But I want you to be one of the 100, and this will get you right to that site. str.org/partner, okay? And then join the ranks. Be one of the 100. Now, a couple of weeks ago, maybe more than a couple, maybe a couple months ago, I don't know. I lose track of these things. A while back, I talked to you about morality and I was thinking more in the abstract how the existence of objective morality is an argument for the existence of God. Okay, I've talked about this before, and I talk about it a lot for a couple of reasons. One reason is because I think it is one of the very best arguments for the existence of God. Absolutely, hands down. And the reason it's such a good argument for the existence of God is because there's something that everybody knows, no matter where they lived or when they lived, they all know something is wrong with the world. Now, that's classically called the problem of evil. They all know something bad is going on. Okay? And by the way, this is one of the biggest complaints against God. Ironically, it turns out to be one of the best evidences for God. And the way I've often put it, I'm not going to go into the whole argument right now, but the way I've often put it is there can't be a way that things are not the way they're supposed to be unless there is a way they're supposed to be. And there can't be a way they're supposed to be unless you got a sposer. That is, there's got to be some kind of design in the universe that God intends for the way we behave, and people don't behave that way. That ain't right. That ain't the way things supposed to be. And that's the problem of evil. And without a way the things are supposed to be, determined by a sposer, you cannot have a violation of supposed to be, and therefore you can't have a problem of evil. The problem of evil is evidence that morality is objective. Now, that's the basic moral argument, and if you got it, good. If you didn't, oh, that's right. I want to make a different point here because we got some pushback. Well, let me back up. What we did is we did a red pen logic dealing with an atheist who is trying to make the point that all morality is relative. Okay. Now, what I said just a moment ago is if morality is relative, that means it's just up to the individual and people have their own moralities and that's it. There is no law above everyone. There is no problem of evil. And that makes total sense. You can't break a law that doesn't exist. So you can't have evil if there isn't objective good that is violated. Okay, this is pretty straightforward. But we are make the point, and I do especially, that, you know, relativistic morality is just in your head. It's just subjective. It's in the subject, which is why they call it subjective morality, relative to the subject. But this atheist did a post, and his post were that he disagrees. Morals aren't objective. Now, keep in mind, if somebody says morals are not objective, they must surrender the problem of evil as a complaint against God. I gave you the rationale for that a moment ago. But here's the reason why the atheist said morals are not objective. And he says that for every action that is immoral in one set of circumstances, it turns out there's another set of circumstances when that action is completely moral. So it may be wrong to kill in one set, but when circumstances change, it's right to kill in that set of circumstances. Therefore, he claims, morality is relative. Now, the problem with this is that this person, who I think he has advanced degrees, I'm trying to remember who this individual is. But in any event, he just misunderstands the difference between relativistic or subjectivistic morality and objective or objectivistic morality, okay? And in this red pen logic, we respond to his piece. Now, if you don't know what red pen logic is, it's the brainchild of Tim Barnett on Stand to Reason. He was a teacher, and so he would take his red pen to his students' homework and, you know, mark it and respond to it and correct them. And so he had this idea to take some of these posts and do the same thing. And we've been doing that now, six or seven posts, and he's got a video that goes with it. And it's if you haven't seen this, you need to go to YouTube type in Red Pen Logic, watch a few, and then subscribe, all right? We have more than 7,000 subscribers already, and we've just done a handful of these things. And I think they just go out every couple of weeks. So people are responding really well. One of them had 300,000 views, all right? These things are fun and they're instructive. And our point was that, look, you're misunderstanding the moral project, because subjective relativistic morality is mind-dependent morality, okay? Let me unpack that for you. That means when you say a thing is right or wrong, the rightness or the wrongness is simply in your own opinion about it. That's why people say, well, it may be wrong for you, but not wrong for me, or that's your morality, not mine. Notice how the morality is grounded in the individual, or in other words, the subject, which is why they call it subjective morality. So all relativistic morality is subject-oriented, not object-oriented. So when, for me as an as a objectivist, when I say rape is wrong, I'm talking about the action. I'm not that action out there in the world, that thing, it is objectively wrong. I'm not just saying, in my opinion, it's wrong for me, but it may be right for you. And that's all we can say about it, because that's all there is. So I think you get the general idea here. And so we were chastising this person for saying that morals are always relative and they're never objective, simply because the moral rule that applies in any situation changes when the situation changes. Well, that's objectivism, because morality always depends on the nature of the circumstances. Is it wrong to push somebody? There you go. There's an action, pushing someone. Well, doesn't it depend? If you're playing football and you push them to get the ball that's been fumbled, that's not wrong. That's part of the game. But if somebody is in line in front of you at the bank or wherever, and you push them out of the way so you could advance your position, that is wrong. The pushing action is exactly the same in each case. The nature of the circumstances is different. And therefore, since the objective circumstances are different, then the moral action is different too. So objective morality is always relative to the circumstances, which is what the individual, the person in this post pointed out. It's always relative to the circumstances. Now, he thinks that's relativism. No. Objective morality is always relative to the circumstances. Subjective morality is always relative to the subject. That's why you could have totally different answers about the same set of circumstances. Is it wrong to push the guy in the line at the bank? Well, if it's wrong for you, then it's wrong for you. But if it's right for me, it's right for me. That's relativism. That's subjectivism. So in our response, when Tim did his Red Pen Logic, he's clarifying these particular points, okay? And we get a response back, a kind of Blue Pen Logic from the atheist who posted. And he makes the point that God has a mind. Therefore, if we're grounding our morality in God, then we are grounding it in a subject, and therefore our morality is subjective because it's grounded in the mind of God. Okay, so touche, back at you. The Trinity is three persons. Bada boom, there you go. And this is meant to be a broadside at our correction. Okay, now I just want to make a couple of observations about that. Okay. Because in the piece, he says, circumstances, not God, always determine objective morality. Always. Okay. Now, here's the question I have. Actually, three of them. Circumstances tell you nothing by themselves. Think about it. The point is that circumstances are the raw material that you must assess by some other standard. So when the atheist says circumstances, not God, always determines objective morality, always, he's kind of half right. That is, you have to assess the circumstances, but you must assess them with something. And the thing you assess them with is the moral rule. And the question is, where is that moral rule coming from? Is it coming from an objective standard or a subjective standard? Okay. And he wants to say, well, okay, well, if you say God, then God is a mind. And this is my second observation. Well, that's true as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough. Because there's more to it than this. This is somewhat of a straw man, because our claim isn't that it is God, whatever he says. You know, and he makes a comment, I think, that in his piece, in the subject, God decides what's right or wrong. He's always right by definition. Well, in a certain sense, he's correct, but he's missing something really important. God is right by definition, but he isn't right because he simply decides. Now, there is a view called voluntarism that holds that God grounds morality, and the thing that makes something moral is God's mere decision. Okay? He says it's wrong, so it must be wrong. He is correct by definition. So if he says rape is wrong, then rape is wrong because God said it. Okay? And if God changes his mind tomorrow and says rape is right, then rape is going to be right by definition because God said it. And this is where the atheist is misunderstanding the theistic viewpoint, because we are not claiming that God is right simply because he says so. That would be relativistic in a certain sense. That would be grounding right and wrong in God's subjective whim, and when his whim changed, the moral rule changed. But that is not the way theists, who at least know what they're talking about, and that's why I'm telling you all this. This is when you get down and have to dial down and be more precise about this. This is the way it works. This isn't the way we ground it. We are not grounding things in God's subjective choice, called voluntarism. We are grounding morality in God's objective character. It is not grounded in his choice. It is grounded in his character. And his character is good through and through. He is the model of moral perfection. Okay? And that's the foundation. Now, it might turn out that the good God does choose to require one thing at one point of time and something else at another point of time, but that's because under those circumstances, that's the good thing to do. And so his decision does make, is a factor in this. What he says is a factor in this, but it is not grounded there, but it's made good in, not in virtue of his choice, but in virtue of his character. Okay. The last thing I think here for the atheist who responded this way was that he still hasn't responded to our original concern, which is what he described was moral objectivism, not moral relativism, which shows that he, and this happens. I'm not looking down my nose at anybody. I'm just saying he doesn't understand the field. He doesn't understand the nature of objectivism versus relativism. Incidentally, a lot of people have this problem. Oh, I know, I remember. Wasn't it about 6 weeks ago that I talked to you about a pastor who had really gotten on my case, calling me a relativist because I was talking about under some circumstances, note that, under some circumstances, it can be right for same-sex couples to adopt a child or take a child out of foster care or something like that. Well, that he didn't like that. He thought it was relativism. But that's another example of somebody not understanding the actual difference between relativism and objectivism. Okay, so I'm sympathetic. I think this concept is a hard concept in some ways, but it is valuable if we get it. It's important to get it right because it matters, okay, to larger things, not just our moral decision-making, but it also matters to our case regarding God. And by the way, I won't get into this now, not enough time, but if you've heard of the Euthyphro dilemma or Euthyphro dilemma from Socrates, many philosophy students are aware of this, and atheists will bring it up. This is the way it's solved. itself by going to the character of God as the objective standard. It is not God's mere will. It is his character from which his will flows. And if you know the dilemma, you realize that's the way it's resolved. Anyway, Amy did respond to this piece. I thought her words were helpful. She says, yikes, when she read with the atheist, because she saw the misunderstanding immediately. Things don't become right because God says they're right, she writes. He says they're right because they're objectively right according to his objective and unchanging character, which is, by the way, the resolution of Euthyphro's dilemma. He's not simply right by definition. That is, it's not that he could say anything was right and that would make it right, but because he is actually objectively right. And even though all morality is tied to his character, she continues, unlike with subjective morality, there's still one right answer morally in any situation because there is one standard that does not change based on different people's perspective. That is, their mere subjective preferences is what she's referring to. No matter whose perspective is eyeing the situation, God's unchanging character is still the objective standard. Okay, good for you, Amy. You're right on top. Yeah. Right with me. All right, super duper. All right, time for a break and then to your calls on Stand to Reason.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
That's hot music, man. I feel like dancing. I was listening. I don't know where I was the other day, but I was in the airport in DFW, and on my way home, and they were playing all the 60s stuff, and I loved it. There's just nothing like that. Maybe it's just because of what I grew up in and with, and there's all this, late 60s, early 70s, that kind of stuff. When I was in high school and just early in college, it just it warms the cockles of my heart. You know, it's really great. So I don't know why I'm telling you that. But all right, let's go to Mark in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Mark, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you, Greg, and thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Long-time listener, and also we've been strategic partners for quite a while as well. So,
wow, thank you.
I want to echo what you said earlier. I highly recommend anyone who has benefited from this ministry, sign up.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for your partnership.
Sure thing. My question revolves around the fact that I have a friend that has been recently speaking with someone in a Hebraic roots type of movement. Yeah. And one of the things that they've been discussing is Matthew 5:17-20.
Yeah.
And this individual is claiming that Jesus is here commanding the observance of all of the commands of the Torah. The passage starts out, "Do not think I have come to abolish the law or the prophets, but to fulfill." So
right.
I'm familiar with your analogy that the law for Christians is kind of like California law versus the law in my state, and the fact that it never was intended as it's a covenant between God and the ancient Israelites, not
correct.
Between God and
that's
Gentiles.
One line so, exactly. That's one line of reasoning. Good for you.
Right. Okay. I have two questions today. The first is this plain statement of Jesus that whoever annuls one of the least of the commandments and teaches others to do the same seems to run counter to Paul and other statements that Jesus made that indicate that the law was set aside or abolished in some ways.
Yes.
So how do you personally see this passage in light of those others? How can we understand Jesus' words here without doing violence to the text or without it seeming like we're just trying to get around this tough saying?
Sure, sure,
and,
okay.
And then the sure.
No, did you have more?
The follow-up question would be, considering this is in an ongoing conversation between my friend and this other individual, how would you recommend maneuvering tactically in that conversation?
Sure.
Given that it might take a bit of nuance to kind of tease out what might be going on.
Of course. So let me try to answer the first part, and then you can remind me about the second part, all right?
okay.
But I think you are onto something when you suggested, well, wait a minute, how does this work with Paul's own statements? And this is a very important observation, because Paul's statements appear to be just as clear as Jesus' statements in Matthew 5. They both seem to be clear and unequivocal. But if you take them in the clear and unequivocal way that people take them, you have an obvious contradiction. And Paul doesn't say it one place. He says it quite a number of places. If righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died needlessly. All right? For example, he also says in Galatians chapter 5, if you are seeking to be justified by law, then you are severed from Christ. And the one who is in the Spirit, as it were, is not under the law. He says that later on in the chapter, you know, walk by the Spirit, you'll not carry out the desires of the flesh. And so you have this continuous theme by Paul. We see it in Romans also. For him who works, then it's reckoned to him as a debt or what's due. But for him who does not work, but believes in a God who justifies the unrighteous, to him it is reckoned as righteousness. So the unrighteous is reckoned as righteous even though they're not working. For by works of the law no flesh will be justified in his sight. I mean, these are all other passages, and I'm just going kind of by memory. I can't remember exactly where they all are, but you're familiar with these if you read the New Testament. So what this then creates is a clear, the obvious take of Paul's comments, multiple comments, and on what seems to be a prima facie take on Jesus' comments in this one passage, it looks like you have a contradiction. So I think both sides in this discussion are obliged to try to rectify the contradiction. If you just sit on your verses, you implicitly affirm a contradiction in Scripture, and that's not going to help either side. Okay?
Got
with me so far?
Yeah.
I have more to say about the issue broadly, but it just strikes me as a tactical matter to ask the person just straight out, do you think that Paul's writings has the same level of inspiration as Jesus' words? Now, if they have a high view of Scripture, the answer is yes. The red letters have no more authority than any other letters in the Bible, okay? Because even Jesus' words are copied down by apostles, all right, and sometimes summarized. Okay, yeah, good. Well, then, does Paul say the same thing that Jesus seems to be saying here? All right, so that's a tactical question. And by the way, for those who know the tactical game plan, this is Columbo number three. That is, I'm leading up to a point that I hope will refute this view, but I need a bunch of stuff on the table to get to that spot, and I'm putting it on the table by asking questions of the other person, who then affirms what should be obvious to affirm. And when they put this little piece on the table, they're participating, they're helping me in solving the problem. I'm enlisting them as an ally, is the way I put it in the new tactics book, the 10th anniversary edition, where I developed this a little bit more. So I'm stepping outside of our conversation and narrating what I'm doing here for those who are familiar with that maneuver, if you will. So is Paul equally inspired? Yes, he is. Okay. What does Paul say about this kind of stuff? Does Paul say that we're obliged to keep the entire law, every jot and tittle? I'm using language here from Matthew 5. Well, if he says yes, you can ask him, where does he say it? Show me.
Right.
The actual thing is, he says exactly the opposite. So how can Paul and Jesus say the opposite thing? So I'm still in my little role play here, my tactical role. How could they be saying the opposite thing if they're both equally inspired by God? And the answer is that they can't be saying the opposite thing. We must be misunderstanding someone in this particular case. So here, now I'm out of my role play and back with you, Mark. The reason, let me back up and put it this way. In the case of Paul, we have multiple references to the law not being the criterion by which we are justified. It is the criterion by which we're judged. Essentially, that is in Revelation 20. But it's not the criterion by which we are saved, okay? And so he makes this case many, many places. And it's not just statements, it's an argument. He gives a rationale. The book of Romans is an argument. He starts in one place and he adds and adds and adds and then comes to conclusion. The free gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. He spends three chapters to make the point that all have sinned. And then he says the free gift of God. Okay. Everybody's mouth is closed under the law. Okay. Now, that's an important point. Paul is making an argument to show that the law silences everybody before God. Okay. And in this case, so we've got all of this kind of body of information, Paul, from lots of different angles, from different books, developing a line of argument in these different places, is making one point, and now we have Jesus seeming to make the opposite point here. So my natural inclination is to think Paul is right and Jesus is also right, but I'm misunderstanding him in Matthew 5. Okay?
Okay.
You with me so far? Okay, so then I got to look at Matthew 5. Okay, and I see a number of things that are going on here. Let me just sum up this flow of thought that I see in this section. And Jesus says, I didn't come to abolish the law. And then he says, I didn't come to abolish but to fulfill. Oh, wait a minute. Wait, that seems like we'll come back to that in a minute. But that seems like, what does that mean? Because if the law can't be abolished, but it can be fulfilled. And if it's fulfilled, it's not effectual anymore. It seems. That's what it means to fulfill it. It's satisfied. Okay. Well, let's just keep reading. We're just going to leave that. I didn't come to abolish, but to fulfill. It's like, that's different. Then he says this, and not one letter or stroke of the law shall pass until all is accomplished. Oh, there it is again. Yes, the law until. Yes, the law until. He says it twice. Okay. And then he says stuff that's pretty hard. Okay. You can't annul it. And this is kind of, I think, the main point of these few verses. You are not going to get rid of the law as a way of avoiding its demands. But then he goes into a number of examples. The ancients have told you, you shall not commit murder. Well, that's in the law. But he says, but then I say that if you're just angry with your brother, you'll be guilty. before the court. If you tell your brother you're good for nothing, you should be guilty before the Supreme Court. And if you just simply say, you fool, you're going to fiery hell. Notice that it seems to me that Jesus is including under thou shalt not murder other demands, and he's decreasing the seriousness, but he's increasing the punishment. If you're angry, you're guilty before the court. If you just say, oh, you good for nothing, oh, you're guilty before the high court. If you say, you nitwit, you're going to hell. Well, what do we take from that? What he takes from that is that command not to murder covers a whole lot more stuff than just not murdering someone. All right? Then he goes into other illustrations. Okay, don't commit adultery. I haven't done that. I'm safe. Wait a minute. Have you thought about it? Got me there. Absolutely. Then you're guilty of another sin, not adultery, but adultery in your heart. Okay. So Jesus is giving all of these, your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off. If your eye makes you stumble, whose right hand hasn't made them stumble? Whose eye hasn't made them stumble? What's going on here? And then you get to the end of this section. And it says, you are to be perfect as my heavenly Father is perfect. Verse 48 of that chapter. Okay, there it is. And I think what Jesus is doing in this whole section is he is doing the same thing that Paul is doing in Romans. He is placing the force of the law so heavily on the shoulders of the people who are trusting in the law that they despair of ever keeping it. That's what I think is going on here. And so Jesus is saying you can't just get rid of the law. No, the law's there. Now, there'll be a time when it's fulfilled, but for now it's not fulfilled, so now you got to keep it. And this is, and by the way, it means this, not just this, but it means this too. And this little thing, oh, you got you there. And that, we got you there. And by the way, you got to be perfect. How perfect? As God the Father is perfect. So, again, what Jesus is doing here in Matthew 5, in my opinion, is the same thing Paul is doing in Romans 3, I think. And he's summing up and he's saying that the law has closed every mouth and everyone is accountable to God. Jesus is giving the bad news. Jews, you can't get rid of the law. Nope. You say to somebody they don't have to keep the law. Boy, that's bad news. But you can't keep it either. That's bad news. Now what? You ready for good news? Well, Jesus is the good news. Come unto me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And I actually think when Jesus said that, he wasn't talking about people who are depressed and having a bad day. I think he was talking more about people who were deeply overwhelmed by the demands of the law, which Jesus simply underscores here in this passage. So if your friends are saying, we have to keep the law, and the argument I've made in the past is the law is only for Jews, not for Gentiles. The Mosaic law is for Jews, not Gentiles. But even here, these are Jews. Well, maybe Jews have to keep it. And Jesus is saying, okay, yeah, here's what it requires. Okay, you could ask your friends, have you ever lusted after a woman? Duh. Okay, then you're guilty. That's it. It's the end of things. You haven't kept the law, period. You don't keep the law you're telling us to keep, which is the exact same thing that Paul said early on in Romans, chapter 2, I think. Okay, so Paul and Jesus are in the same boat here. They are making the same case. The law cannot be kept. That's why it must be fulfilled. And Jesus fulfills it. Okay, do you follow the logic there?
Yes. Okay, so there's a lot there. I'm going to have to kind of chew on it a little bit. But yeah,
that's all right.
I think that I was following much of it. One of the things that you said that I should have thought of this, and I'm very glad that you brought this out, is that our understanding of one of the two must be mistaken. The distinction between me saying, well, the Bible says, well, no, my understanding of the Bible is this, and I could be mistaken. The Bible's
sure.
Not mistaken, but my understanding of it could be. So,
right.
Pointing out the tension between the two and then using the tactical questions to try to tease out, well, if there is a a seeming contradiction, then which one of these two am I misunderstanding?
That's right. And I am at this point trying to make the point that if you take it the way they're taking it, there's a contradiction. If you read the whole passage, it turns out that Jesus is making the same argument that Paul is making in Romans, you know, right. that everyone is shut up under the law. So we're all lost. Too bad if that's the way you're going. So too bad, so sad, you know, kind of thing. Okay, but it gets better in this one. I mean, I think so far this is a good case. It's a good argument to show that Jesus is not making the point that they think he's making. He is placing the burden of the law on the Jews. Okay, that's old covenant. We are in the new covenant. This is an entirely different world now that we're in. But the old covenant demand, what they were under at the time he's speaking there in Matthew, the demand is this. You can't get rid of the law. That's not your out, guys. You can't abolish the law. Okay, and then he gives this hint about fulfillment, and then we can make this case about the fulfillment of the law, and Jesus on the road to Emmaus is talking about how the law and the prophets and the writings fulfillment of all of those things. You can make the case that this is the fulfillment, and so it satisfies. Jesus on the cross, tetelestai, it is finished, it's accomplished, paid for. That's okay. So there's a whole case there, but there's something else that your friends and probably you have not thought about. Paul wasn't the only one who said the law doesn't apply. Jesus said it too. Are the laws regarding the dietary laws, kashrut, are those part of the law?
Yes,
they are. Now, if Jesus says not one jot or tittle, like the dot of an I or the cross of a T is going to be removed, that includes the kosher rules, right?
Right.
Got to keep them. But wait a minute. In one of the other Gospels, maybe even in Matthew, but later on, Jesus declares all foods clean. Contrary to the law of Moses, Jesus declares all foods clean. He says it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, it is what comes out of a man that defiles him. Consequently, the text says, Jesus declared all foods clean. So it turns out that if Jesus says you can't take away one jot or tittle from the law, and it just means what they think it means at face value, then why is he contradicting himself? So it's not just problems with Paul, it's problems with Jesus
right.
in the Gospels.
Right.
So, and that should be more reason to take a closer look at Matthew 5 and say, I think we're misreading Matthew 5 if you're trying to make
right.
the application you're making. Fair enough?
Right. Yeah, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time, Greg, and thank you for your insights. I really appreciate it.
All right, Mark, I appreciate your call. Thanks for that. And this just makes the point that, sometimes these things are a little bit more tricky, all right? And sometimes the prima facie understanding, the on the face of it kind of understanding, could be wrong. And that's why we apply this principle called the analogy of faith. That means we go back to the scriptures and we interpret the unclear in light of the clear. Now, I know somebody might say, okay, which one's the clear passage? I mean, that's a debate. Maybe Jesus is the clear passage and Paul is the unclear passage. Okay. Well, this is why I pointed out that Jesus' comment is singular here in this case. In other words, this is the spot where he says, keep the law. It isn't like a consistent theme all through there that somehow we are to be all law keepers. All right. And observant Jews, all right? But Paul says the opposite many times and in many ways. So this is a hint that Paul's stuff is the more clear. And then when we look at Jesus contradicting himself, apparently, then that raises another question about this. And so this is why I think we should look more carefully at this passage and see maybe we're misunderstanding it. And then as I went through it, I think there is a rationale that we can see that makes Jesus' comments consistent with Paul's comments and with Jesus' own comments in other passages. So we have a way of reconciling the apparent contradiction, and it's completely legitimate and completely consistent with the New Covenant teaching. Okay, so we've solved the problem. Now, if somebody says, no, I'm going to stick on this, I say, okay, how do you solve the problem? How do you make all of these statements of Paul's and the argument of Paul's to really be, we're misunderstanding them, he's really advancing keeping all the law. And by the way, this isn't just a principle for this passage, but it's a principle for a whole bunch of passages. Whenever you run into problems where one person has one side with their verse and the other one has their side for their verse, then you got to figure out, okay, we either have a contradiction or one of us is misunderstanding something. So let's take a look at both sides and see who can do the best job of reconciling the apparent contradiction. All right? You're not going to be able to do that with everything, but that's basically the strategy involved. Who can do the best job of reconciling the apparent contradiction? Okay, now I got no more callers. I have something else I want to talk about, though. I got about 8 minutes. About 9 minutes to go. I'm going to find it here. My sister, this ought to be just enough time. My sister, Sue, my elder sister, she's a year and 2 weeks older than me, so we always had our birthdays like right around the same time. That is, we had the same birthday party. It made it easier for my folks. Anyway, I'm June 10th. She was May 27th. She sent me a note, and she'll ask me questions. She's a very committed Christian, very godly gal. She said in 1 Samuel 15:19, God allows Saul to conjure up a meeting with dead Samuel. Isn't this contrary to all the Bible says about not speaking to the dead? And in Deuteronomy, it says you don't call on the dead. And by the way, in my view, this means you don't pray to saints. I mean, just think about that. I don't know why people haven't thought about that. It's a practice of some Christians, not just Roman Catholics, by the way. But these are people who are deceased. And it looks like Deuteronomy forbids that. And in the case of 1 Samuel 15, Saul, the king at that time, now Samuel is dead. He's all nervous about a battle coming up. And so Saul had been his confidant and his guide. Samuel had been his confidant and guide, but Saul had not fared well because Saul was very mixed in his obedience. And he finally forfeit the throne effectively because of disobedience. Now, that change of hands doesn't happen for a number of years when David takes the throne, but in any event, so Saul is on the outs, and Samuel's gone, and Saul's in tough straits. And so what he does is he goes and he disguises himself because necromancy, calling up the dead, is strictly forbidden, and it's a capital crime. And so he goes to the witch of Endor, and he disguises himself, and he asks the witch to call up Samuel. Okay, so how is that? My sister's saying, well, God allows that, as if God is giving his approval in a certain fashion. So I just made a couple of observations for her that you guys might want to think about. This is another one of these kind of problem passages, or at least initially seems to be. And I said, Sue, look, first, God allows all kinds of things that are sinful. He never tells Saul to do this. It does not give us permission, okay? Saul's acting on his own here, right? And as I point out, he did it deceptively. He's disguising himself from the witch, because if the witch knows who he is, she's not going to break the law in front of the king, right? Bad, dangerous. So he's got to disguise herself and trick her. So there are all kinds of nefarious things going on here, and God's not approving of them. Now, he didn't stop them, but he doesn't. There's lots of sin that God doesn't stop. And here's the second thing. The witch herself seems to have been a fraud. And the reason I say that, and I could be mistaken about this, but she was actually caught by surprise when her conjuring actually produced a real spirit. All of a sudden, Samuel's coming out of the netherworld and he's showing up. Now, this could not happen unless God allowed that. I acknowledge that. All right. When Samuel is conjured, the witch of Endor says, "Oh my gosh, that's the real thing. He's him. You have tricked me. Who are you?" You know, kind of thing. And then Saul, you know, reveals himself to her, but he says, "Get on with the business here. I want to talk to Samuel." And so, God does, in a certain sense, cooperate at this point, and Samuel comes back, and Samuel's mad. He said, "You woke me up, man. I was doing just fine. I did not want to come back here." And it turns out that Saul was consequently punished for his actions, and the punishment was, the price was his life in the battle that was to follow shortly. I think it was the next day. He was going to lose his life, and he would also sacrifice the lives of his two sons, who included Jonathan, David's best friend. That's a bummer. All right. So he's getting punished for those actions. So God's not all in favor of this. And here's the fourth thing. You know, this is throughout the Bible, too. God has the liberty to use sinful actions for something good. And incidentally, that's a good thing. Thank God that's a good thing. Romans 8:28, "For we know that God causes all things to work together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he predestined to become conformed to the image of his son." In other words, God's going to work things out here. And no matter what bad thing it is, you trust in him, and he is going to use it to conform you to the image of your son. So that's an example of God taking a bad thing and making something good out of it. And he does that all the time, which is good, because there's lots of nasty things that happen in our lives that it's great that God can redeem. I think it is odd that he allowed Samuel to come back, but God can do what he wants in those circumstances. That's up to him, okay? And just as an example, notice that even David's marriage to Bathsheba came as a result of murder and adultery, okay? And the son that they conceived in the adultery ended up dying, and that was the consequence of their sin. David himself was forgiven, but there were consequences. And the consequence was, first, the boy died, and secondly, his house would be divided. And so he fought for the throne that God promised him against Saul, and Saul died, and he got the throne. And then later in his life, he's going to fight with Absalom, his own son, who takes his throne away, at least for a season, until Absalom is killed. And so God takes that bad thing that happened, and with Bathsheba, and guess who her son is? Bathsheba's son is Solomon. Solomon is the next king. And both Bathsheba and Solomon, of course, are in the lineage of the Messiah. So we see this throughout Scripture. Yes, God does allow people to do wrong things. And many times people look at stuff in the Bible and they say, "Well, what kind of God would do that?" As if God was doing it. Well, God didn't say to do that. People do their own thing. You know, and a lot of times people, what they do is wrong. It's not approved of in the Bible. It's just recorded there. And sometimes we keep reading, we realize, no, God didn't like that at all. However, God can still step forward. He still can take the bad circumstance, the sin of others, and he can use it for good. Hey, think of Joseph, for goodness sake. Here's Joseph. You know, he's the youngest brother, just about. Benjamin was younger, but he's annoying. He's got these dreams, and in these dreams, he's better than everybody else, than the elder brothers, which that's bad news when you're better than the elder brothers. And so they made it look like he died, and they sold him into slavery, and it was this same Joseph that years and years and years and years later was the means by which God rescued all the brothers. So, in fact, his dreams came through. They were bowing down before him. And at the end of his life, you know, they were concerned, you know, that Joseph was going to take revenge. And Joseph says, and this is towards the end of the book of Genesis, "Look, you meant it for evil." And they did. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And that was Joseph's perspective. And so we see this time and time and time again, God taking the evil that other people do to us and transforming it into something good. And we don't always see it right away, but we can trust that God knows what he's doing. All right. Good ending thought for the show. I'm glad you've been with me. Sign up as a strategic partner, str.org/partner. Hope to see you there. See those numbers boost until next week. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.